to reconvene, I just wanted to pick up on a comment that Karen made about partnering. And I was hoping that we could move the conversation a little bit over to every organization is doing an amazing role. And every organization, and I think about this in our daily work too, we sometimes get involved working in a little bit of silos. So I wanted to talk a little bit about organizations and how we can collaborate and partner together, especially when many patients have more than one chronic disease and are probably supported by more than one organization. So I don't know if anyone on the panel wants to take a try at that.
Sure, I'll start. So, of course, kidney disease is strongly linked with diabetes. So I've been working with the Canadian Diabetes Association. Primarily at the start, we've been holding patient roundtables in First Nations communities in particular, asking people to connect the dots, as we call it, between living well with their diabetes to prevent kidney failure. So we've been really focused on the prevention side. But I could see some potential for actually working together on end-of-life care coming out of that collaboration. It's hard for an organization to collaborate with other organizations because we're all underfunded, overworked, exhausted, and we have our own members and supporters that we really make our first priority. So for us, patients always come first, and their patients and their families always come first. But I think there is an opportunity through just working together to actually start thinking about what might that kind of workshop look like. And I pass it over to you to see if you'd like to do that.
So she's got my attention because she said diabetes. So I'll step in with that. And I agree. I think if many of the people here that are involved in chronic disease, if we can actually work together as partners, and I think that will strengthen our approach and also what we come up with as far as a plan, and then together implement that. And I think we could be very successful. And also with the thought of integrating the self-management approaches within that whole picture, I think we could, at the end of the day, have serve our population well. And I'm hopeful, and I'm passionate, so I'll sign up with you.
Okay. I think there's also an opportunity then to collaborate on material development, because I think part of what we're hearing is there's probably should be one kind of tool that we all agree would be a good patient tool to actually help encourage people to keep track of their own records. And I love the little green sleeve. I thought that was a neat idea that I'm going to steal and take back. But it seems to me that I think all organizations work from evidence-based research, and we should be able to come to some sort of consensus on what might that patient plan look like that we could share and implement. And it sounds like the Cancer Agency has done a lot of advanced work already on this, so we might be able to steal ideas from you.
Right, and I mean, there are already many different online resources. I mean, my criticism of the My Voice, although I do like it, is that it's a fairly high reading level. I think it's at least high school or university. And I have some patients that are low literacy and have English as a second language. So there, NIDAS has wonderful resources. There's other online resources that are simpler and have simpler language. But I agree, tools, sharing tools and resources. I'd be happy to share the tools and resources that we've developed for sure.
Level. And does that make sense to have some sort of standard so it doesn't matter where you live in British Columbia, you're going to get Maybe there could be some nuances because of different conditions, but the same standard kind of assistance?
I just wanted to say something, Del, and then we can have it over to you. I'm thinking of what we've done to date in diabetes and Fraser Health that I'm very proud of, but for the last couple of years, we've sort of taken that approach about anyone, say, living in Hope will get the same service and coming into our centers as if they lived in Burnaby or White Rock. So what does that look like? And so having that coordinated with diabetes, what's the potential of working with other diseases and combining that approach, whether it's through looking at different topics of exercise or activity or nutrition, etc., but also raising it to a health authority approach, delivery, and that anyone in the health authority, wherever you live, you will be guaranteed that same access and the same quality of care and services. And so I think that's sort of how I see that develop in a very simplistic way. I mean, there's lots of detail under that, but that's how I would probably approach it.
Can I just say, though, I would disagree. I think that's the objective and that's the goal, but currently in British Columbia, it matters where you live. I'm sorry, if you live in northern BC and you're treated for kidney disease by the Northern Health Authority and you live on Haida Gwaii, or you live in Stewart or Atlin or Fort St. John, you've got to travel 2 days to go see your doctor, right? Mm-hmm. It's a different world when you get out of the Lower Mainland. I think the Lower Mainland has really great, easier access. Mm-hmm. There's more of a linguistic and cultural barrier that's happening here, but you get outside of the Lower Mainland, it is really a geographical difference, and it does make a difference in people's care. And I think in one sense, that's where the system working with patient organizations can really collaborate effectively, because our reach is slightly different from the healthcare reach, where we can actually get into people's homes through our networks, possibly as easy, if not easier, than sometimes the systems can get there, because we have direct mailings, we call in, we do community events. So I'm not sure it matters where, I think it still matters where you live.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think in addition to that, you know, I was talking kind of perspective of a health authority, but certainly a provincial approach. Mm-hmm. But engaging not just healthcare professionals, but all organizations, mm-hmm. like non-government organizations, volunteer associations. Yeah. Even last week, having the privilege of sitting on the Patient as Partners workshop, acknowledging patients and their voices is just so critical in outlining and talking about what care looks like. And I think all those pieces, like I said earlier, it was just a very simplistic response, but keeping in mind all those other organizations that we need to partner with and work with. Yeah. Della, sorry.
Yeah, I was just gonna comment because Doris is out of the room right now, Dr. Barwick, but when Lorraine Gerard mentioned at the beginning of the day this notion about a partnership, and a number of years ago, for those of us that have been around a while, we talked about coming together as, you know, community organizations, providers, and one of the things for me in relation to talking about culture change. Mm-hmm. So the culture is changing because we're having a different conversation now than when this was kind of talked about maybe 10 years ago, because there is a different readiness, and I'm so impressed to hear what each of you are doing in relation to your organizations, and I think thinking about, when Patrick was talking about the place of healthcare providers within the whole person's experience of living with different kind of chronic illnesses, and just recognizing that, you know, we're a small player, important, but in context to the whole experience of somebody living with different kinds of conditions. So I think this idea of coming together in partnership is an awesome idea, and maybe the time is now. Maybe there's a readiness now where there wasn't before, because it seemed to be, well, what would we come and talk to connect with the Palliative Care Association, because that's not about what we
I'll just say I think that when we think of health charities collaborating and working in partnership, and I think that's sort of, those are values that probably all health charities share. But what we're really saying when we say that is that what we have to share, really the resources that we have to share, is our volunteers, really. Mm-hmm. That's where our strength is, for the most part, our reach is. And the volunteers that are being trained through self-management kinds of programming, and I think creation of common material around, like we have for chronic pain, but maybe for end-of-life planning, and those kinds of things done professionally, that we could all deliver in communities and around the province and in the northern communities and small places would be a huge step forward. Just thinking of who, we were just talking a few moments ago about who starts the conversation about end-of-life planning or hospice care. If it's the physician or the health professional, then the person or the patient is receiving their sentence. This is the life sentence. Oh, they're talking about palliative care. It looks like it's over for me. However, if it was a family member that talked about it first, or a community member, a volunteer in a program that they attended, it's much safer for the conversation to begin at that point, perhaps. So maybe the goal for us is really to think about creating material that we can collaborate with or share in that sense.
Can I just follow up in one thing? What we've learned from iPanel research is, just to follow up on your point, is what we've learned through the iPanel research that we've been doing is that this work is best, and I'm curious if this one is best embedded with versus it's a threat,
right? That's
to
smart.
Others. So Fran was talking about, they're just going to do some work on COPD and congestive heart failure, about self-management. it's very different if it's a threat than if it's a focus. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that we're certainly hearing through our nursing research, is the suggestion of the threat strategy rather than the block of focus strategy.
Could you explain that in simpler English?
Sure.
For me, I don't understand.
Okay, so for example, we're the term palliative care has become, it's about a thing or a change. It's like you're palliative versus you're living with an illness that has a progressive aspect to it. And so that's even a different language. For the ones that do, it's kind of like this. It's uncertainty. There's unpredictability around what that looks like. But for most people, it has a progressive component. So that's just threading in the notion in a way of describing the illness that actually embeds, from my frame, palliative care into the conversation. It's just acknowledging. And when you were talking about dementia, that you said at the very beginning, you know, right now this is an illness people die from, you know. So, or that there is a dimension of describing some progressiveness and depending on the illness. So that's versus describing it and then having a session about this is an illness that progresses. And another one would be around acknowledging that people have symptoms that their disease medications don't completely deal with. So with arthritis, it's acknowledged you might need pain medications or strategies to deal with pain. With COPD, you might be taking all your medications, but you're still breathless. So there's other options for that. There's other kinds of medications that can be used out of the traditional disease ones that are typically talked about in that session. So that would be more picking a thread.
So one of the threads has to be psychosocial, not just
right.
And loss.
And about loss.
Yeah, exactly.
So my comments is, well, first, thank you very much for coming out today. I feel I've learned so much more about your individual organizations as well as a few things about other chronic illnesses. Having said that, I think But when we talk about palliative care, I'm hearing right now today an awful lot of talk from a medical profession's point of view. There's so much more to a person than the condition or the medications that you're receiving or their symptoms. If we are going to fully support someone who is living with a chronic illness, let's support them fully. Mm-hmm. I think if we could even just reach out to each other with the hospital societies, it's a huge way of helping with those difficult conversations. We've been having those conversations every day.
I had a couple of just real quick points, if I could. Just one is, we do have a beginning tool. We have the My Voice, and I think there have been a number of criticisms of it, but it's a fabulous place to start, and I think we could do more with it, making it plainer language, integrating online and other resources from each of our organizations. I think we could do more with that, and it might help to have a specific focus. And my second point was, I forget, so let's move on.
Well, when you talk about the My Voice, I think one of the things that we really notice at hospice and at end of life is people are just inundated with packages and information, right? You get the funeral home, you get the bank, you get your accountant. You're just inundated with paper, and you're just not psychologically able to deal with it most of the time. Yeah. And so we provide simplicity is absolutely key to it working. And it's more about using that in partnership with the personal presentation and walking beside the individual through the process. And I think that's the role that we as hospice volunteers provide.
It's more about the process than the paper. And I did think about what I was going to say, and it was I've been thinking about how have we changed societal attitudes around drinking and driving, because I think that's a case study where we really have changed societal attitudes, and it's macro and it's micro. It's you go to a party and people have designated drivers and yada, 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 but we also have legislation. So we kind of have to do the same thing, I think, about advanced care planning and end-of-life conversations. Sorry.
I just want to raise a topic that hasn't been addressed yet, and that's the topic of grief. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you for your comments about, yes, the physical, the medical component is important, but equally important is the psychosocial, the spiritual component. I've had scleroderma for 12 years, and I'd say that my grieving around my diagnosis began the day I heard I had scleroderma. Mm-hmm. I have had anticipatory grieving. I'm not just grieving the physical loss, but the loss around financial, having an unpredictable future, loss of roles. I'm lucky enough to be a mother, but for many years I was under the impression that that was not something that was in my future, so I was grieving the potential loss of never having my own family. So thank you for raising that. I just want to say, too, I'm also a nurse. I just want to say that the topic is difficult. Even as a patient, it's difficult for me working in palliative care to even bring up that conversation, even when it's so needed. And I just want to say we all bring our personal biases. We all have our own experience. And we do bring that bias. And as much as it's very difficult to do, it's really important to kind of leave those biases at the door and sort of let the patient, the individual, guide the conversation. But if you're uncomfortable with the topic, they're uncomfortable with the topic. And I think we need to start normalizing the experience. And the other point I just want to say is, why do we only talk about advanced care directives and such issues at the end of life?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's something that I would love to see happening much earlier on, at a point when it's not knocking at the door, when we can think about it and say, okay, approach it from a sense of empowerment and say, you know what, this isn't me succumbing to my disease or giving up. This is me being empowered from the beginning to the end. And that's how I'd like to see, as a patient, as a nurse, that's how I'd like to see us approach that in the future, as a means to empower patients, and for us to get more, as the healthcare professionals, to become more comfortable with that conversation and making it part of the everyday conversation as well, and not just something that we deal with when we're at a crisis point.
Sorry.
I can't hear you. That's integration. That's integration.
Exactly. So that's the idea of the thread, is it part of the visit, whether it was intended to be or not. And there are many visits where we don't get to it because the blood pressure just takes up the visit. But it's there, so when they go home and they see what the plan is for the blood pressure, they still see this question. Every day to keep an open conversation with my own daughter. There isn't anything I would not touch.
Can I just make one comment? And I have maybe an idea to get started. I certainly concur with Karen's comments about us as in nonprofits having a real lack of resources. Time being the number one, probably. There are many more things that we could be doing than we actually are able to do. But there's some good conversation happening here today, and I hear a real interest in partnerships. And so I'd like to put forward an idea that maybe the BC Hospice and Palliative Care Association could maybe take a lead in creating an online community that includes people that are interested in this and including the disease-specific organizations so that we don't lose this train of thought. It's easy for us, I think, to go back to our worlds and not carry this on. But I know that I would love to receive emails about what's going on in the hospice and palliative care world in order to be able to keep it top of mind within our organization.
Great idea.
I think that's great, and I hope that our organization might be up to the challenge. Can you pass the mic?
Okay.
Back and then over to.
Last year, our society was honored with a grant from the Order of
St. John's.
Sovereign Order of St. John. And we thought we would do a patient toolkit around end of life. And when we investigated all of the information, it was going to be yet another of those packages I was talking about.
If we're talking about possible partnership, one of the things that has been mentioned here this morning was about possibly creating certain materials. And I would just like to say that before we think of going there, it would work to inventory what already exists, right? So we don't recreate the wheel. As someone who's worked in information and referral services for many years, I know it's not always easy to do these inventories, but it is possible. Along the lines of the work you're doing at Oceanside Hospice, at the Family Caregivers of British Columbia, we have received funding from the Ministry of Health, and we are updating our website and expanding the list of resources that were available on the island to now cover all of the province. So certainly we would like to be part of conversations about that. I do have one question. So we know that My Voice is one model to look at advanced care planning. I did have the good fortune about 2 years ago to be in a focus group with BC Cancer Agency because they were looking at developing their own tools. So we have that model. And certainly I would be interested in seeing it. I don't know if it's on your website or where I might look at it. My other understanding was the Parkinson's Society was also not happy with My Voice, and they developed their own tool. So just in terms of different models for advanced care planning, there's lots of models out there, even if we could start with inventorying that. It would be helpful, I hope.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Sure, no stupid questions.
No, it shows my ignorance on this. How many of the tools that we have available right now have been evaluated? And I ask this because there was a American-developed renal palliative care tool that was developed in the United States, and then they just finished evaluating it in the Canadian context, and it didn't work. So it seems to me, as an organization that values evidence base, I'd be interested in talking, one, about what tools have been evaluated and shown to be successful. Two, the way we tend to work is from grassroots up. So what we tend to do first is we go out and we have a conversation with the patients, and we talk about what they need, and we develop the tools from their input and then lead it up with expert guidance from our clinicians and our researchers on how to actually make sure it aligns with clinical practice guidelines, that sort of thing. Are most of the tools developed that way, or are they developed top-down? That's my second question. The third question is, there's a program out called from CIHR, the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, called the Strategic Patient-Oriented Research Program. They've had a call. There's about 45 organizations. Diabetes is one of them. Kidney has some money in there, is in the last stage. By October, they will be coming out with who are going to be the four networks across the country that they're going to fund. In that, what there is in kidney, I don't know about the others, but there's a commitment from each of the provincial kidney groups, kidney government-funded organizations, and BC Provincial Renal Agency in particular, that they will work with organizations like ours to develop tools working with patients. They will evaluate it, and then if they are proven successful, implement them throughout the system. So it seems to me there's like an opportunity here, if we don't have those tools, that we should actually be looking at if we want to partner. I think there's an opportunity there. But I think it's really important that we ensure that what we're using has been evaluated. And I don't know. I just don't know.
I would definitely agree with that. And I know in the work that we do at Children's Hospital, we always look at developing evidence-based. I think some areas are more into that than others, and certainly we don't do anything without families and patients' mm-hmm. voice on that. At this point, we're basically out of time.
I want to add one thing.
Okay.
It's kind of relevant. Some of you don't know who I am. I'm Ross Cadell, and I'm the advisor to the BC Hospice Palliative Care Association. And there's a project I've been working on, just behind the scenes, so it's not an announcement today, but that it's relevant to what you're saying about inventorying these programs that are out there. I've done basically an inventory of all of what I would call the opening conversations. So less the kind of my voice documents and programs, but more what comes before that. I've inventoried that globally. So we have easily 50 examples. And what we might do, because of what you said, is have you involved in the evaluation of those ones. We go through them.
So I think at this point, I want to extend my thanks to the panelists for coming and participating, and also to...
Sorry. The nephrologist said, mention respecting choices as well.
Yes.
It hasn't validated.
Yeah.
Because as far as I know, it might be the only one that has actually been
And I want to thank each and every one of you for sharing your expertise and wisdom in the room. And it just seems like this hour and a half wasn't long enough, that we were just getting rolling and starting to generate some really good ideas. But what I hear is there's a real will to move forward in a collaborative spirit and to share, and definitely some ideas that came on how we can start that. And so we'll certainly be taking these conversations away and trying to find some forward movement. So thank you very much.
Thank you.